Final case for the day is Cheryl Heilman versus West Penn Allegheny Health System. Mr. Ward.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. Joshua Ward on behalf of appellant Cheryl Heilman. This case comes to before the court after the district court entered summary judgment, among other things, on a failure to accommodate claim. The court has primarily asked the parties to address whether West Penn had an affirmative duty to inquire about the prospect of a reasonable accommodation under circumstances, and has directed the parties to compare this court's decisions in more recently Condeen v. MBNA America Bank with Taylor v. Phoenixville. It's appellant's reading of the cases that they are not a conflict, but rather they establish a singular rule. The cases decided 4 years apart.
Okay, I do want you to get to the substantive thing, but I do want to hear about your conduct in this case. Should we sanction your motion to supplement, and if so, what sanction? I'm very concerned that your motion to supplement cited a number of cases where the citations were correct, but they weren't quotations and principles. They looked like AI hallucinations.
They did, Your Honor. I investigated that issue, and my letter brief that the court asked me to file is, as far as I know, accurate. I was able to determine that from our Dropbox system that I had, in fact, edited the document, so I know that it wasn't a misstep that somebody filed the wrong Microsoft Word version. So I must take responsibility that I did not check the citations for the cases citing a fairly simple and narrow rule, 10E, and that is on me, Your Honor. Certainly didn't intentionally seek to mislead the court, merely a lapse in judgment because, frankly, if I can be, not an attempt to be flip, but so casual, I had assumed that such a simple issue couldn't be hard-pressed to misquote it, and I apologize for wasting the court's time and counsel's time. I understand this is a very easy.
I get it, but I'm especially concerned, you know, after the sanctions that we affirmed in Cefali about your, you know, Fair Credit Reporting Act lawsuits. This is two is not a pattern maybe yet, but it's not an isolated incident either. So how should we think about that?
Well, Your Honor, the lawsuits in Cefali and Malcolm were filed by an associate of mine, Mr. Gordon. I was not the drafter, and the issues, I think, are different in that Cefali and Malcolm, you know, I had retained an ethics expert, and I'd gone down there and all.
I understand, but it looked like a representation that certain things were, in fact, handwritten by your clients on their own when, in fact, you appear to have directed a paralegal to submit these things. And it leads to some concerns about kind of the thoroughness and carefulness with which you're preparing and reviewing filings.
I understand, Your Honor, and I'm trying to address it as best I can. I think the two issues, the causation, perhaps, you know, Cefali, Malcolm, my firm, and ultimately me, who made a judgment call to defend the conduct, we were wrong, and we accept that. We accept this court's opinions on that and do not dispute that. This matter has been pending for some time, and it is true that to the best of my recollection and the investigation that the court asked me to conduct in it, that ultimately, of course, it falls on me, and it wasn't a Scribner's error. I edited the document.
Have you investigated how these erroneous citations wound up in the document?
We did. And at that point in time, all those years ago, the landscape has since changed in terms of AI and how we're able to guard against the errors in the caniper.
So what about reading and just checking that the document submitted to the court is accurate? And were you supervising the attorney, and did your firm get compensation for the representation?
Can't dispute that I have a duty at all times to read all case law and pin sites. I did not do that. The gentleman that drafted the document was not an attorney, but a law student. I believe it was a one- or two-page motion to supplement citing Rule 10E. I admit, I simply assumed and did not check those pin sites. Had I done so, I would have easily discovered the error.
All right, please, move on to the merits.
Yes, Honor, thank you. It's appellant's reading of Taylor and Cunningham that they're not in conflict, but rather that they establish a single rule. It's just that Cunningham is a bit of a flip side of the duties, an explanation of the duties that an employer may have whenever a triggering event occurs,
okay,
which is notice of, number one, a disability and a desire for some accommodation.
Okay, so you're basically continuing the first point, which is, you know, when I read 42 U.S.C. 12112B5A, the limitations, physical or mental, have to be known to the employer.
Correct.
But you also note, our case law says, not just the disabilities, but the request for an accommodation. So under FMLA, FMLA talks about explicitly making a request, but the ADA case law similarly suggests that ordinarily you make a request. Now, we have a couple of cases where the disability is so obvious. We had an advocate who came in here yesterday, his arm was in a sling. If your arm's in a sling, I ask, can we help you, right? Or someone comes in a wheelchair. But there's nothing obvious about your client's diabetes or diabetes medication. You're nodding. I don't see anything about it that would have made it obvious. The first time the employer knows about it is right when she's being confronted with the misconduct, and her response is, I wasn't sleeping, maybe I was resting my eyes, I've got diabetes. Even at that moment, maybe the employer now knows about the diabetes medication, but the employer still doesn't know anything about an accommodation or a request for accommodation, right?
Well, on let me address both points in turn. One is legal, one is factual. In Taylor, it speaks to this point. In Taylor v. Phoenixville, the court remarked, and the facts of the case were such that the employer did not know the reason behind the alleged misconduct when it occurred. And the first step, much like this case in Taylor, was that the defendant had cited the employee, Ms. Taylor, for misconduct, and only at that point, it was not even Ms. Taylor herself that informed the defendant of the disability, it was the son. And then they, you know, expressed some desire for accommodation. And that is why I believe the Taylor decision was necessary as precedent, because it built upon Mangin, which said there's a two-party good faith standard where, you know, the employee must in good faith try to make it known, and then the employer must reciprocate and affirmatively seek. But in Taylor, that was just the issue, is what happens when the employer doesn't know of a disability and then cites an employee for a possible infraction, and then the employee makes it known. And Taylor specifically spoke to, I wouldn't say it relaxed the duty, but it made clear that it is a relaxed duty on the part of the employee. And we talk about a triggering event. All the employee must do is make it, you know, reasonably clear that they want assistance for his or her disability. And so to your point, it is in fact true, the facts of this case arose in a very short time frame. We have July 11th is when we have the Ashball report from a colleague. It was equivocal. It said that, you know, she reported to Mr. Lust that, I think I might have saw Cheryl Heilman sleeping, but I'm not sure. And that was consistent all the way through her deposition testimony. And it was on either July 13th or 14th, depending, small discrepancy in the record, Ms. Heilman's calendar said the 3rd or the 14th, and I think Mr. Lust had it at the 13th. Not sure that it matters a great deal. But Mr. Lust addressed his subordinate, Ms. Heilman, and levied the allegation, much like in Taylor. And Mr. Lust did not dispute, and Ms. Heilman also confirmed that in that meeting, she said that a few things. She denied sleeping. She said, I have diabetes.
She did say, I may have shut my eyes or been resting my eyes.
Possibly. I think that was, you know, there was some testimony on that.
Right.
And she gave a medical explanation, much like in Taylor. She said, I have diabetes. I'm on new medication. My doctor's adjusted that medication. It gives me, you know,
okay. But she doesn't ask for anything. She doesn't ask for a different shift. She doesn't ask for something else to help her keep awake. It's just that she just says that.
Yes, and what in your view would a reasonable accommodation have looked like here?
Those two points I'd like to address at the same time because I think they build on one another. And Conine makes this very clear that there is a duty to inquire, right? And that, you know, the specific, Your Honor, Judge Bevis's point was that at that particular moment in the July 13th or 14th meeting, that singular meeting.
Wait a second. In terms of, there's no magic words, but when I'm looking at Conine at page 332, the employee must make clear that he/she wants assistance for his disability. The employer must have enough information to know of both the disability and desire for accommodation, quoting Taylor, or circumstances must at least be sufficient to cause a reasonable employer to make appropriate inquiries about the possible need for an accommodation. So what's the accommodation that, you know, the employer should infer, like, hey, I should be giving here? You're not saying it's take me off night shifts or something.
No, Your Honor. So this point was key in the Aranis case. I know that it's not precedential, but it's oddly, you know, in 2019, you addressed a very similar case and wrote an opinion about it. In that case, in Aranis, that very question was what defeated Ms. Aranis by her own testimony on element four, which is what sort of accommodation could you have that could have saved your employment? Ms. Heilman's facts are entirely different because when asked by Ms. Mariah McGrogan, defense counsel at the trial level, Ms. Heilman was clear in her testimony. She said that, you know, number one, what she wanted was not to be disciplined, right? She was like the Taylor case, an accusation of, you know, you broke policy was being levied against her. And she was saying, here's my excuse. It's a medical reason. You know, I have dry eye. I would like to be excused from discipline. Number two, when she was asked the question by counsel as to what sort of accommodation she would have needed, she posited a number of things. And if you'll allow me just a moment to flip ahead in my brief. She said, quote, I don't know, maybe a couple days off or different medications. That appears at Appendix 271 through 272, Heilman deposition, page 161. And when defense counsel clarified that her medications were not something West Penn controlled, Ms. Heilman narrowed it to exactly the kind of accommodation an employer can theoretically provide. Ms. Heilman said, quote, just probably a couple of days off until I corrected it. I did not request it because I didn't know that I was allowed to. In that statement, the I didn't know that I was allowed to is precisely the reason why Conine, it is clear that there's a duty to inquire. And that's the question that the courts asked us about, is did they have a duty to inquire? And that whole, if that aspect of the rule, if you will, is to be given any force and meaning, then the duty to inquire must recognize the flip side of that is that the employee might not know how to ask or exactly what to ask for.
It seems like the rule you're asking for is anyone who is on the brink of being fired can then, if he thinks quickly enough, raise a disability as an explanation for the misconduct. And in that case, the person has to be given a few days off and a second chance.
No, Your Honor, respectfully. The rule that West Penn is asking for is that there is a temporal cutoff, and that was what Ms. Paulsgraf was explicit about from the beginning, and that remains AHN's position. They are saying that Ms. Paulsgraf, the HR representative, who ultimately made the decision and told Mr. Lust to carry it out on the 19th, she knew the facts. She was in receipt of the July 17th email, and Mr. Lust had reported it to her orally on the 14th. That's not disputed. So she knew. And in this instance, unlike Arana, Ms. Paul's graf considered that there might be a duty to, you know, inquire. However, Ms. Paul's graf came to, in appellant's view, an improper legal conclusion by imposing a temporal limit. She was clear. Paul's graf, her testimony, and, you know, when I was deposing her, that she felt that there was no duty to offer or discuss any accommodation because in her mind, she read some EEOC guidance that she interpreted that because Ms. Heilman had not made an ADA or FMLA request prior to being cited for discipline, in this case sleeping, that there was a cutoff point, and therefore beyond that, there's a duty to inquire. So this is not a case where in Aranis, where the employer was left guessed because they had already given that employee FMLA, and that employee, Ms. Aranis, when asked, said, I don't know what you could have done for me beyond, you know, the intermittent FMLA that I was already taking. She never followed up again, Ms. Aranis, and asked anymore, and her testimony, you know, made it clear that there was nothing to be done.
So there's another passage in Canine at the bottom of 332 where it says, look, just because, despite MBNA's prior knowledge of Canine's morning sedation, the interactive process requires an employee in her position to do something more than proffer excuses of heavy traffic, giving a parent a ride, cleaning up after a pet when asked to explain tardiness. What we have from her is, I wasn't sleeping, but then, yeah, I might have closed my eyes. But then I'm a diabetes, dry eyes, you know, I'm going to pray about it. Maybe I'll try new medication. Like, this isn't obviously a, hey, I got a disability, new disability. It's like she's throwing a bunch of stuff against the wall here. So I don't think this meets this requirement that the employer would know, hey, what she actually needs an accommodation for something that's caused by a disability. That is what she said clear enough?
I think it is, Your Honor, because you have to consider the, you know, inherent truth of their conversations, which was that it began with an accusation that, you know, Ms. Heilman first knew about when Mr. Lust called her for a disciplinary meeting on the 13th or 14th. And immediately her explanation for allegedly violating policy was that if I was seen resting my eyes, it is because I have diabetes, it is because my doctor has adjusted my medication, and therefore it is a one-to-one match where it's not a random excuse like I need to pick up my kids or whatever. It's a medical issue.
I think what my colleague, though, is suggesting, and if you think about it just from the employer's perspective and needing to have people who are actually adequately performing the function, unless there's an accommodation that's given that's knowable in advance that they can plan around. I mean, presumably, common sense suggests that if you're paid for a job, the policies, you're awake to do it. Mm-hmm. So the question is, prior to potentially having conduct that would make it seem like she's violating that, why, if she was on the medication or had dry eyes, would she not have mentioned it to the employer so they could accommodate it, so she wasn't just potentially having drastic consequences for everybody by sleeping on the job at a medical facility?
Two things in response to that, Your Honor. The Taylor v. Phoenixville decision recognizes that very question, and it resolves it in favor of the employee. The court remarked, Taylor gave a reason for placing the burden on the employer, and its reason resonates on the facts of this case. Quote, disabled employees, especially those with psychiatric disabilities, but it doesn't limit it to that, continuing on, may have good reasons for not wanting to reveal unnecessarily every detail of their medical records because that information, quote, could be embarrassing and might actually exacerbate workplace prejudice. And again, recall that Taylor was a case where the central issue was we have a discipline accusation and then the notification of disability comes after.
I just want to go back to understand affirmatively what the reasonable accommodation here is. Are you suggesting, therefore, to avoid anybody having to disclose something to be embarrassing, the hospital's policy should be that everybody can fall asleep at any time they're on the job if they can then show they have a disability. I don't know what the rule otherwise would be.
Absolutely not.
So what is the rule? What's the reasonable accommodation?
So a few things, Your Honor, and I want to answer your prior question and immediately answer the question you just asked me. This is not a case where Ms. Heilman has said or would ever say that she has a disability to such an extent that it would disqualify her from doing her duties at any point in time. She was asked about that and testified, you know, that she wasn't sleeping and that she, you know, it's not like she was accused of missing anything with a patient or anything like that. And that's why she didn't ask for FMLA leave as well. There's some testimony about that. But in terms of case-by-case analysis and how this case should come out on the facts, which I believe is what your question is really driving at, of course not. In a medical setting, we cannot. That rule that West Penn has is, of course, a sound rule. Nobody should be able to sleep on a job. However, you have to reconcile it with the ADA, and you have to consider the context. For example, in Arana, where the employee of the hospital was sleeping, it wasn't a first offense. It was repeated, and she already had an accommodation, FMLA leave, intermittently for this, and kept doing it, and was seen sleeping under a blanket in the break room. This is not that case. Ms. Heilman was facing a very equivocal allegation from Ms. Ashbaugh, and Ms. Ashbaugh was very clear, even on the record under oath with me, that she said, I have no idea if Cheryl was sleeping. You know, her eyes were closed. That's all she could say. And that is congruent with what Ms. Heilman said. What we're saying is not for some blanket rule that, you know, allows people to sleep at West Penn or really anywhere else. We're saying on the facts of this case that on that allegation, and given Ms. Heilman's explanation, which was pretty consistent with what Ashbaugh was willing to, how far Ms. Ashbaugh was willing to go in terms of what she saw, when there's an allegation of discipline, and if it can be reasonably explained by a medical explanation, and the employee defends themselves, and therefore expresses a desire for some relief, then the duty to inquire is triggered. And particularly on the facts of this case alone, we have an HR person, Ms. Paulsgraf, who admits that she was aware and made a conscious decision not to make any inquiry because in her mind there was some temporal cutoff that doesn't exist under Taylor, Cunningham, Jones, or any other interpretation.
Thank you, Mr. Ward. We'll get you back on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Please do tell us how you pronounce your last name.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Your last name, how do you pronounce
it? It's Hages.
Hages, two syllables with a soft G. Okay.
That's right, Your Honor. Well, good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Ted Hages for the Appley West Penn Allegheny Health System. Unless Your Honors would like me to begin with a particular topic, I'd be happy to very briefly address the sanctions issue and then turn to the merits, which is where I'd like to spend most of my time today. On the issue of sanctions, we respectfully defer to the wisdom and judgment of this honorable court.
Did you spend any additional time because of these possibly hallucinated citations?
We did, Your Honor. As soon as we saw opposing counsel's motion to supplement, we investigated the citations, saw something was awry, and then had to do the digging and investigation to check every site.
Can you give us a ballpark estimate of how many additional hours partner or associate time were necessitated by that?
I'd be happy to submit that to the court after argument if that would be helpful, but I can tell Your Honors it was, you know, multiple thousands of dollars were spent on this issue, and there was also some time spent in pre-argument prep to answer Your Honors' questions about the issue of sanctions arising from this conduct. We think this is a serious issue. You know, as the court said in McCarthy, the submission of fabricated citations, you know, has real-world consequences. It wastes this court's time, it wastes parties' time, and unfortunately, clients have to bear the expense of that. For that reason, multiple of the federal courts of appeals have responded to this issue with appropriate sanctions, and the sanctions have included anything from monetary sanctions, referral to disciplinary authorities, and even dismissing an appeal. And third, while I sympathize with counsel's contriteness, I have absolutely no doubt to that. Respectfully, counsel's letter does not deny that there were fabricated citations in the paper submitted, that counsel failed to review the cases or have an attorney do so, which is all the more important when a law school student is working on the matter, and that counsel failed to file any corrective filing after we submitted our own response and notified counsel that, you know, there was something wrong with the citations. And we think that that conduct, in addition to, you know, as Your Honor mentioned, the Sofley case, there's a number of other cases, district courts within the Western District. There's, you know, I know of at least three more, and there's more than that.
We don't need the citations. It would be helpful if you could just follow up in the next few days with a letter kind of summarizing your best estimate about the billable amount of partner associate time, hours, what it would add up to your standard rates for the court in the next 3 days, if that's okay.
We'd be happy to do that, Your Honor.
Okay. Go on to the merits.
Thank you, Your Honor. On the merits, I'd like to dive right in and begin with Your Honor's pre-argument question, which is whether West Penn had an affirmative duty to inquire about the prospect of a reasonable accommodation under these circumstances. The answer to that question is no, Your Honors. Under controlling law, employers have a duty to inquire about a need for accommodation if, but only if, the employee's disability and with that disability are known to the employer. And so if the employee fails to make her employer aware of her disability and need for assistance before she then proceeds to commit a terminable offense, the ADA does not require the employer to excuse that past misconduct based upon a post hoc utterance, a mention of a disability for the first time in the disciplinary process. Now, this controlling legal rule, which the district court rightfully applied to reject plaintiff's claims as a matter of law, flows from three things, Your Honors. That's the text of the ADA, this court's precedents, and longstanding guidance from the EEOC, which memorializes this controlling rule that courts across the country have applied consistently and without any outlier that I'm aware of. So to begin with the statutory text, as Judge Bevis, Your Honor, noted, the ADA requires employers to make reasonable accommodations as to the known physical or mental limitations of an otherwise qualified individual. That's 42 U.S.C. Section 12112B5A. So the operative word there is known. That's when the duty is triggered on the employer. But equally important, Your Honor, is what the statute does not say. The ADA does not require employers to make accommodations as to unknown disabilities, nor does the statute impose any affirmative obligation or on the employer to engage in an inquiry or investigation into their employee's potential medical circumstances. Had Congress intended to impose such a duty, it would have been very simple of Congress to write that into the statute, but of course there's no such language there. And in fact, the very opposite is true, Your Honors. In that very same statutory section, that is at section 12112D4A, Congress provided that employers, and I quote, shall not make inquiries of an employee as to whether such employee is an individual with a disability or as to the nature or severity of the disability, unless such examination or inquiry is known to be job-related and consistent with business necessity. So employers actually are generally prohibited from asking the type of affirmative inquiry that my friend on the other side has called for here in this case.
Your friend is suggesting, okay, but once she brings up the diabetes, then the employer is supposed to figure out an accommodation or something like that. What's your response?
Well, two things, Your Honor. What the plaintiff in this case brought up was, number one, after she had already been reported for fireable conduct that she had a disability. That, Your Honors, is too late. And that's too late under this court's precedence, and that's too late under the EEOC guidance. And I think the EEOC guidance says this in the clearest and most on-point fashion. So this is guidance that's been around since 2008.
What's the citation?
It's actually in our brief, Your Honors. It's the EEOC enforcement guidance applying performance and conduct standards to employees with disabilities. We cite that in full in our brief. And in this longstanding, now almost two-decade-old guidance, the EEOC answered this very precise question. What should an employer do if an employee mentions disability and or the need for an accommodation for the first time in response to counseling or discipline for unacceptable conduct? The EEOC instructs, and I quote, If an employee states that her disability is the cause of the conduct problem or requests accommodation, the employer may still discipline the employee for misconduct. If the appropriate discipline action is termination, the ADA would not require further discussion about the employee's disability or request for a reasonable accommodation. And now, Your Honor, this is a controlling rule that has been applied by multiple district courts within this circuit, all applying Third Circuit law, and they have all in unanimous fashion agreed that when a disability is raised for the first time after the disciplinary process has already gone underway because terminable misconduct has been reported, that is too late. And then those cases can be seen on appendix pages 50 to 51. And Your Honors, in an effort to fully respond to Your Honor's pre-argument question about what type of duty is triggered and when and what are the circumstances that call for that, we took a look at other circuits as well, Your Honor. And what we found was a unanimous consensus across the circuits that no duty arises on the part of the employer on a fact pattern like this one because of that time element. So to highlight just a handful of those cases for Your Honors, the First Circuit in Jones versus Nationwide Life Insurance, 696 F3rd 78, has stated, when an employee requests an accommodation for the first time only after it becomes clear that an adverse employment action is imminent, such a request can be too little, too late. Or as the Second Circuit has put it in Mackley versus County of Orange, 700 F3rd 635, a requested accommodation that simply excuses past misconduct is unreasonable as a matter of law. Or as the Fourth Circuit has said in Halpern versus Wake Forest, 669 F3rd 454. The law does not require the school to ignore misconduct that has occurred because the student subsequently asserts it was the result of a disability. Such an individual has not sought a disability accommodation, but a second chance to better control his treatable medical condition, which is not the cause of action under the ADA. Or take the Sixth Circuit's recent decision in Schock versus Webster Industries, 2025 U.S. Appellate Lexus 24066, which specifically invoked the EEOC guidance on which we rely and reiterated that the timing of the request is crucial, as an employee does not have to rescind discipline, including termination, warranted by misconduct. And last, but certainly not least, Your Honors, consider Hill versus Kansas City Area Transportation Authority, 181 F3rd 891, which applied this very same principle to hold that an employee was not immune from termination, where she never told her supervisors that the medication she was taking left her uncontrollably drowsy on the job until after she committed the offense of sleeping on the job. Your Honor, there's a uniform consensus, and that consensus exists for a reason. It also aligns with what this court said in Conine and Taylor. As these courts' precedents recognize, perfectly consistent with the statutory text. In fact, Taylor makes that very same point. This notice requirement derives from and is consistent with the ADA's focus on known disabilities. This court said that employees have a duty to put their employers on notice and order, and I quote, to trigger the employer's obligations under the interactive process. It's the notice that starts the whole process, Your Honors. Taylor makes plain that employees must make clear that the employee wants assistance for his or her disability. And as
speak a little to what makes that clear, because I think that's really the heart of the issue here, is we have said in some instances, even if you don't use the words, I need an accommodation or I need help, we've said nonetheless, the need for accommodation or the desire for accommodation was clear enough. And let's just say the timing here is not an issue. What type of, in your position, what type of statement or conduct would meet that standard, make clear?
Certainly, Your Honor, and I perfectly agree. As this court said, there's absolutely no magic word requirement. There isn't a bing, 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 you have to say the word accommodation. But the employee must make clear that he or she wants assistance for his or her disability. That's what this court said in Conine, and that's quoting the Jones versus UPS case, which
what would meet that? What would make it clear? As far as, I'm just interested in what, in your opinion, your legal position, what would make that clear? So, for instance, you know, to Judge Bevis's point yesterday, someone with a sling, it might be clear to an employer that they need help lifting things or whatever the job duties for. So maybe it depends on the condition, how common red eye or fatigue are, if those normally require accommodations. I'd like to know, based on your understanding of the case law, what will make something clear to an employer that an accommodation is desired, though the explicit words are not spoken?
Sure, Your Honor. I think there needs to be some expression of a need for help or a need for assistance. That need for assistance is, I think, the phrase that I see most common in the case law. But as this court's case law has recognized, there's no one-size-fits-all way that an employee has to use in every instance. For example, the Conine case says the employees have an obligation to truthfully communicate any need for accommodation. But as Conine and Taylor reflect, there's a number of ways to do that. The employee themselves can speak with their manager. They can have a family member speak of a disability. That happened exactly in the Taylor case.
So there's no magic words requirement. You don't need to use the word accommodate. You don't need to mention the ADA or the FMLA specifically, right? But you have to do something affirmatively expressed, except in the situations where, like, if you got a wheelchair, you know, it's obvious, look, I can't get up the stairs, help me find a ramp. There are going to be situations where it's obvious we're not going to require something formulaic, but there's nothing obvious about what to do about someone who's falling asleep on the night shift.
Exactly, Your Honor, that makes all the difference here. And in fact, you know, Ms. Hellman herself testified in her deposition that she didn't know she needed an accommodation. Well, if Ms. Hellman doesn't know she needed an accommodation, the employer certainly can't be expected to be clairvoyant, to use this court's words. You know, Conine makes clear that employers don't have an obligation to be able to read employees' tea leaves. So, you know, the timing aspect of this case, we think, is fully dispositive, Your Honors. But even if this court were to get past that, this record simply does not remotely resemble the cases where there was a request for accommodation.
How much are you leaning on the letter that informed her, you know, unrelated to this incident, that informed her how to seek ADA accommodations and FMLA leave? And is that shifting? I'm just interested, like, is that a reasonableness of your belief that an accommodation is not being sought because you told her how? Like, how much are you relying on that, and what's the legal principle?
Sure, Your Honor. So I think the letter is very relevant and helpful for that very reason. Just within 6 months of this incident, plaintiff received the disciplinary action form based on repeat call-offs from work, and on that form it explicitly gave with another example that many employers use to say, you know, here's one way that you can communicate the need for assistance for us. And that letter specifically said, you can contact HR to, you know, request FMLA leave if you need it or a reasonable accommodation. You know, it's undisputed here that plaintiff didn't do that. But it's certainly not our position that was the only way she could have did it. It was certainly an option that was made very plain and very clear to her within a very close temporal proximity to this event. But we don't think that is an absolute critical necessary thing to affirm. It doesn't appear that the district court thought that either, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Ward.
Thank you. This case, factually, when we talk about, you know, what type of accommodation was needed, that question is a moving target in any case. We're not asking, you know, there has to be, to meet the fourth element, there has to be some possibility, right, some feasible accommodation. But we never got there here because, assuming you agree that the triggering event happened, that the employer was on notice, that circumstances or statements, and circumstances I'd like to emphasize because that word appears in Conine. We have to take the statements in context. The context here is you violated a rule, same as Taylor. The employee is now telling you that they have a medical excuse. At that point, I think that the rule in the Third Circuit ought to be clear that there is a trigger to at least engage. Once the interactive process is engaged, then both sides have a duty to be candid.
So your friend on the other side has a couple of responses. One of them is,
too little, too late. All these other circuit cases say when you're on the brink of being fired, you don't get a second chance by bringing it up. And you have no evidence that she brought this up until after she was confronted with sleeping, which she denied, but not unambiguously. And sleeping on the night shift is a fireable offense. So why is that fatal to her claim?
Well, Your Honor, I think in order to reach that conclusion, I think you'd have to overrule Taylor, because Taylor was all about the fact that the employer didn't know that there was a mental disability and they saw this woman deteriorate. And then only after she came under scrutiny for discipline did they learn that the reason was a mental disability. And there's, you know, I'm not sure of the cases out of circuit or the trial court cases or district court cases that defense counsel or appellee's counsel is citing, but I do know what Taylor says, and I do know, practically speaking, all we're asking for here is for the court to recognize that on a case-by-case basis, and certainly in this case, circumstances should dictate.
Well, this is a situation. Taylor was hospitalized, and so he's hospitalized. He's got lithium. There's a letter about lithium levels. You know, that's more like my hypo of the person in the wheelchair or Judge Chung's of the person in the sling.
Well, Your Honor,
like that, no hospitalization, no wheelchair. So how is this, how would this require us to overrule Taylor?
Query, Your Honor, what's worse in a medical setting, a no-call, no-show? What's more dangerous to patients, a no-call, no-show, as in Taylor, or, you know, being accused of shutting one's eyes? I think, you know, it's a distinction without a difference legally. The point I'm trying to make is if somebody's accused of misconduct for the first time and the employee has a recently diagnosed disability and has a medical explanation, the accommodation at the beginning could be, okay, this might be excusable. But if you keep doing it, if you continue to do it, it's an iterative process.
With respect, I just, the context of this is not about whether there's an excuse. This is about whether there's an affirmative showing of discrimination here, because a discrimination claim was brought. So that's the context. The context is if the employer doesn't know until the time of the termination, is there something about the fact that somebody's terminated for closing their eyes, possibly falling asleep at a hospital center, that shows discrimination by the hospital center necessarily just because the person after the fact says my dry eyes and diabetes might sometimes require me to shut my eyes? Could you just maybe close, unless my colleagues have other, with your demonstration of how there's discrimination against her based on her health condition here by the hospital?
So diabetes is a qualified disability. Certainly if it's uncontrolled and it is affecting your, you know, physical ability or apparent physical, you know, if she's regarded as having some effect on her job. If AHN is consciously disregarding a known right or obligation with respect to a disabled person,
consciously
disregarding.
So they weren't here, obviously.
I'm sorry?
Consciously disregarding. So they weren't here because she was fired before knowing that she claimed she had this.
Well, that is if you accept the temporal proximity proposition that I think is unsupported under Third Circuit law. If you accept that, then there's a, you know, it's basically gotcha. You didn't tell me, even though if you didn't know, and, you know, then if we've decided to discipline you, then we can disregard anything you say about
this. Only because the standard of the law that is trying to be upheld is making sure there's not discrimination. In other words, there has to be a showing the policy, in a sense, is applied, I think, either intentionally to discriminate or that the policy inherently is discriminatory.
That
the policy here is to stay a week at the hospital center.
That can be one of the ways you can prove a discrimination claim. Failure to accommodate is different and has, you know, different elements. But, you know, there's certainly overlap.
Thank you.
Thank you. We thank both counsel for briefing and argument. We'll take the matter under advisement. I would ask, as I did ask at least counsel, by close of business Monday, just submit a 2 or 3 page jail space letter just detailing what you can demonstrate in terms of total number of hours and at whatever billable rate and any additional expenses that were incurred as a result of the hallucinations in the motion to supplement. And with that, the court will adjourn, but first we will greet counsel at sidebar.